Who on Saturday night, no, it was Friday night, wasn't it? Who sat up on Friday night and watched the Bourne Ultimatum? There must have been some of you. Almost everybody in this morning service knew the Jason Bourne movies. Aren't they great? What's not to like? I mean, for you girls, mate Damon, for us guys, action and chases and fights and exotic locations, and it is such a fantastic story. The whole series of, there's about half a dozen books and three movies, and they're just terrific. And so I actually didn't stay up to watch it all the other night because I was really tired. But I taped it and I watched the rest later on. But the Bourne, the whole, there's a great theme running through the Bourne series of movies. And it's about, as just for those of you who don't know, I want to recap it to you because it carries itself as a certain illustration for what I want to talk about tonight in this this reading in 1 Peter. So Jason Bourne was an operative trained by the CIA. He was a fairly normal agent who volunteered for a special assignment to be properly trained and programmed as an assassin. He gave up his old life and was a cold-blooded killer. In the first movie, he actually was found almost dead because at one moment he had a conscience attack, you might say, and spent most of the movie, the first movie, trying to rediscover who he was, how he came to be the assassin that he was, and to eventually track down the people who are responsible for him being in the position he was in and that made him what he was. And the rest of the following couple of movies after that are still part of that chase where he discovers the people behind the people who did it all, and layer upon layer of intrigue eventually unfolds. And so in many ways I've spotted a real parallel with the Bourne story of where he became someone new, and those forces that made him what he was were continually trying to pull him in or kill him or attack him for who he now has become, that he now knows the truth, but they want to protect themselves from him, who now has the weapons and the know-how to take them down. In the reading that we had here today, it just reminds me of the scene for us, that we who have chosen to follow Christ are now living under a different set of rules. We have, and I certainly have, and for those who follow him, have rejected the plans and the purposes of what the rest of this world teaches us what to do. And the rest of the world doesn't like it, or they, at least, very least, they don't understand it. A couple of weeks ago, Mike talked about the section in 1 Peter where he says that we might have to suffer under the persecution of others because of who we are and what we have come to believe and who we follow. And that's dealing with the deliberate, malicious attacks of other people who say, you are not, we just don't believe you or trust you. In some sense, this reading is about how we deal with those who we've used to interact before, those who have lived in a certain lifestyle of negativeness or selfish lusts, and how when we choose to turn our back on that, they just, to borrow Jethro's phrase when he was here doing communion, they don't get it. How do we deal with those in our life who just don't get what it means to follow Christ and who, for whatever their reasons might be, malicious or simply they would make them uncomfortable by the change of lifestyle? How we deal with those others who are in our life and are still in our life now that we have not turned our back on them, and that's key, by the way, that we have not turned our back and we have not broken connection with those who have been part of a previous life, that we still talk to these people, but how do we deal with the fact that they say, come on, come back and just indulge a little bit in some of these things. And it may not be obvious. It may just be hints and references in conversations. You might get together, as I do, with my family from time to time. And my brothers, I love them dearly. They love me. But they don't quite think the same way as I do, and I'm the only Christian in my family. And for the finest and most loving family reasons, we'll mention or refer to various things of our past together, of things that we have talked about and done, and say, that's what you really like, aren't you? As if they can't believe that I'm actually different now. With the most loving, best possible mode is where people will say, I just don't get it. Why can't you just be like us? And the change makes everyone else around us uncomfortable. Now, I'm not suggesting, and nor is Peter suggesting, never in the Bible does it suggest that because of the change that has been wrought in our lives, that God has transformed all of those who follow him into a different set of values. Nowhere does it actually say we should then turn our back and not connect with these very same people who our lifestyle makes uncomfortable. But rather, the challenge is to continue to engage with these people, to continue to connect with those who don't understand or don't agree with our lifestyle and our decisions, to continue to show this is real, that for me, for my family, it was so important for me, and it still is, to continue to say that the choices that I've made, the Jesus that I follow, is for real, makes a real difference, And therefore is something that, out of what I say, what I do, may make a difference in my family. Because the stakes are so high, and I need to be sure that what I do, when my family go, I just don't get it, I have to still say, I love you, but this is still the way I'm going to do things. Because I follow Jesus now. I no longer live according to the rules of this world. I no longer want to follow these desires, much as they continue to battle within me, as they do every follower. But I do want to instead deal with the issues in a godly way. I still want to live my life in a way that serves God, where I follow him. So I'm going to reread this reading again, and I've actually got to put it up now, please, Chico. So I thought I'd call this our reborn identity. Okay. That we have a new identity and we've been reborn. For those who follow him, we have a new start. So I'm going to put this reading back up on here, but I'm also going to read it in a translation, in a different version, which might just give you a little bit more of an insight into some of the points that it seems to me that Peter is trying to make in this reading. And it starts out, he says, therefore, and I'm actually going to, I might rewind and just include a few verses before that as well, because as I've always said, if you find a therefore, find out what it's there for. Okay, so I'm going to read the few verses before. And those of you who were here last week when Mike tackled that really challenging part in the end of 1 Peter 3, this whole scenery about baptism which saves and the ark and Noah and all that sort of stuff, I'm just going to include a little bit of that in the lead-in to what I read now. But if you've got an NIV translation, it might sound a little bit different from what I read. This is the New American Standard Version. But I'll read it to you anyway, and this might make a bit of sense to you. Where are we here? Okay, when the patience of God kept waiting in the days of... No, this is verse 20 in 1 Peter 3. Right. The patience of God kept waiting in the days of Noah during the construction of the ark, in which a few, that is, eight persons, were brought safely through the water. And corresponding to that, baptism now saves you. Not the removal of dirt from the flesh, but an appeal to God for a good conscience through the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who's at the right hand of God, having gone into heaven and after angels and authorities and powers had been subjected to him. So now I'll read on from there. Therefore, because of what we just read, because of Jesus having taken all these powers into submission, because of the inclusion of us into Christ, you might remember that Mike talked about baptism and the ark as being a symbol for inclusion and connection, how we now who follow Christ are now in him. The baptism symbolises incorporation. Because of that, therefore, since Christ has suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves also with the same purpose. Because he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, so as to live the rest of his life in the flesh, no longer for the lusts of men, but for the will of God. For the time already past is sufficient for you to have carried out the desire of the Gentiles, having pursued a course of sensuality, lusts, drunkenness, carousals, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. And in all this, they're surprised that you do not run with them into the same excess of dissipation that they malign you. But they shall give account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. For the gospel has for this purpose been preached even to those who are dead. And though they're judged in the flesh as men, they may live in the spirit according to the will of God. Slightly different language, different phrase in there. The NIV is great for reading in public, but there's a whole lot. I don't want to sound like a Bible snob here, but it's a much better version for studying and getting some original meaning from. So remembering this whole, again, I've reminded you of the fact that prior to this we talked about how we are incorporated, we are part of Christ, our identity is in him, we've been saved, and the symbol of baptism, which is inclusion in all that Jesus does, both his good and in his suffering. And this whole theme we've talked about through 1 Peter is that of how we handle suffering. We talked about deliberate suffering, and now we're going to talk a little bit about the suffering, the challenge that comes from those around us who say, I just don't get why you live that way. Why can't you just come back and be like us? So I've got a number of points that I've pulled out of this reading, and hopefully with the same first letter of a C, it might help you to remember what some of these are. And it starts out by saying, arm yourselves with this particular purpose, with this attitude. You're going into a battle. Let's face it, there's a war going on in this world for the minds and hearts of this generation. And even for us, even now, those who've chosen to follow Jesus, the battle still rages. within each and every one of us. The battle still goes on, that we need to take the same attitude, remind ourselves of the purpose for which we are here. We're not here anymore to obey our own desires. We're no longer here to buy things that advertisers want us to buy. We're here, however, to continue and take on the attitude of mind that says, I'm part of Christ now, I'm not part of this. There's a different set of forces working on my life than on the rest of this world. There's a different drive, there is a different purpose. I'm here because I know why I'm here now. Most people go through their life not knowing what their purpose is. They think, well, I'm here to have a job, have a great career, marry, have children, and maybe leave an inheritance. Our purpose is to glorify God, to have connection and relationship with Him, and to share that good news with everybody else around us. Simple sounding purpose, but we remember that is not a selfish purpose at all. That's a purpose that that will glorify God. So in this battle that we face against the world around us, we have to have the right weapons. The attitude is that we need to arm ourselves with a reminder that this is what we really live for. We need to sometimes suffer for the sake of purification, for the sake of a witness before others. We need to sometimes suffer the ridicule that will come about, as I said, for perhaps even the best of possible intentions for our friends, family, those who used to know us to say, really? Is that what you really do now? Why don't you come, you know, hang out with us instead? And we do need to hang out with those people instead. But as I say, it's more important that we show a different set of values and a different lifestyle from what we used to be before we followed Christ. When you read in the Bible where Christ has suffered in his flesh, and where we read about his the cross of Christ, that's talking about not only his physical suffering. When you read the Bible, it says the cross of Christ, we're talking about the humiliation and the shame of his death, not necessarily just the pain. We're talking about Christ suffering. It is the fact that he was made a public spectacle in the most embarrassing, shameful way, the most lowly possible death, and suffered the physical pain, suffered the fact that our sin was put upon him. But when we talk about the shame of the suffering of Christ, it is the fact that he was made to be nothing. And we kind of need to be willing to be made as nothing for the sake of the purpose that God calls us to do. So the challenge is that. Therefore, arm yourselves, confirm within your own heart, decide within your own self that this is what I'm going to do. It's got to start out by saying, I am armed ready, but I'm prepared to face the reality that I'm going to be in a bit of a battle here. First and foremost, that foundation, that challenge to say, therefore, arm yourselves with the right attitude, with the right purpose. And he then goes on to draw a contrast between the human desires that drive so many people and that drive so much of this world with the desires that God wants to grow in us. He says, live the rest of your lives in the flesh, no longer the lust of men, but for the will of God. Not for the will of man, but the will of God. Unfortunately, we don't live the will of God very perfectly. We don't necessarily hear God's voice very well. We don't necessarily grasp the ways that he wants us to live. And we're also, because we are unfortunately human, constantly at war within each of us, that says, even though I'm in God's image, I'm broken. You're broken. You're damaged goods. We are all unable to perfectly follow God's will. But we need to choose to say, I'm not going to live for people. I'm not going to please those folks out there. I'm not going to live for myself anymore, but I will instead please God. Mike mentioned a couple of weeks ago again about the depth of the challenge that we few of us will ever need to face. The challenge that says, you're going to follow God, you're going to trust in Jesus, or you're going to die. Very few of us will ever go through the challenge, the depth of pain that might be, cost that might be paid for being a follower of God, to please God rather than to please others. But there are so many other ways, so many other forces that are so subtle that tend to make us want to please other people. The driving forces of success and recognition, of living a comfortable life, sexual conquest, kids' achievements, the temptation to be successful in the viewpoint of the rest of the world. These are the things that can grab a hold of us. Advertisers, and some of them are really, really blatant about what they want to have to drive us in our buying decisions. Comparison. There's, I think it's SGIO, the ad, where you've got the comparison. They say straight out, well, everything looks good until you compare it with something else. That's what drives the rest of the world. We don't need to compare ourselves and have better and bigger than the rest of anybody else next door. We need to simply be faithful to God, and he will be therefore pleased. We don't need to choose the best thing. We need to choose the thing that will so most effectively show God's will in our lives. We don't do it perfectly, but the statement is simply to say, my purpose is now to please God. I may not do it perfectly. I may not do it all the time. Every now and again, I will be selfish. Every now and again, you or I or all of us will still suffer from that the battle that goes on within each of us, and the old nature versus the new nature. And Peter recognises that when he says, but we will choose, we'll choose to live for God. Peter goes on to talk about the past way of life, and there's a phrase, carnality. That means basically of the flesh. It was the best thing I could come up with that starts with a C. But he's again, in these verses, say 3 and 4, he's comparing again how the past lifestyle compared with the new lifestyle. He says, you've had enough of doing that. He says, you've had enough time, each and every one of us, to whatever degree, to enjoy those things. Now's the time to wrap it up, move on, and to grow up and be serious about how we follow God. He says, the time already passed is sufficient for you to have carried out the desire of the Gentiles, having pursued a course of sensuality. He rattles all off those things. And in all this, they're surprised that you do not run with them into the same excess of dissipation, and they malign you. As I said, it's very easy to lapse back into old habits when you mix with other people who don't seem to believe and how they don't understand the change, because it is challenging and confronting for somebody to see a different lifestyle, to see a Christian lifestyle. That's why in this world, when Christians stand up for what is right and wrong in morality, it says something. We, however, cannot expect to judge the world on the same standards that we do. God holds us to a higher standard. But when a Christian says, I will not live this way, in the workplace, when a Christian says, I'm not going to stack the price of this product for somebody so we make a little bit of extra money, I'm not going to dip into petty cash, I'm going to tell the truth about this product and its shortfalls. When a Christian lives by that integrity in the workplace, in the family, that's challenging. And people see that, and it compares with the fleshly driven drives that attract and attack every other person. Now, I want to point out, as I hinted before, when we challenge others... Actually, I'm going to get onto this now. But that evidence of living a godly lifestyle, the proof that says, I'm going to please God, not my boss, not anybody else, is challenging and can sometimes lead you into trouble. Be prepared for that. But the benefits of following God far and far outweigh the clear conscience that we can have. The fact that we can please God, the one who has chosen to die for us. The benefits are peace of heart, we have belonging, we have safety, clarity of direction in our life, and to give any of those up for the sake of just a short-term gain is not worth it. In verse 5, Peter says that we can have comfort by the fact that these other people will answer to God. We don't have to, we don't need to speak for them, we are not to answer for these people. Every single person needs to speak before God and answer to him for what they've done. They need to eventually stand before God and say, this is how I lived, this is the choices that I made, and God will judge them, the living and the dead, just as he will judge us. It's important to note that when we speak of the judgment God's going to have on other people who have not chosen to follow Christ as we have, we must do so with compassion and with hope and with love for these people, and to be patient with those who do not yet get it. For those who have not yet realised the truth of what we follow, we must be patient with those people and pray for them and continue to love them and go on sharing our time with them so that eventually they will get it. There is no place, no calling whatsoever in our life to draw ourselves away from those who malign us, for those who don't get what we believe in. More importantly, to engage and to connect. I don't want my family, I don't want my friends to stand before God and give the wrong answer when they say, what did you do with Jesus? I would like very much for my family to stand before God and for God to say, I'm glad you chose to follow my son. Because every person must make that statement and that stand, and they must answer before God for that same way. And when we say that, it should be, as I say, with compassion and with fear for the sake of those who have not yet made that decision. And in verse 6 he goes on, he says, the gospel... for this reason has been preached even to those who are dead, that though they are judged in the flesh as men, they may live in the spirit according to the will of God. Right. This conversion process is that we should live according to the will of God, live according to God. Now, verse 6 contains a phrase that some people might, from time to time, misconstrue and misunderstand, and I want to cover that briefly before I talk about what it means to live according to the will of God. There's a phrase there that suggests it goes that the gospel has been preached even to those who are dead. And every now and again, you'll hear someone put forth a theory, the idea that, well, when Jesus was in the tomb for 3 days, he went down and spoke to those who are already dead, gave them the opportunity to repent of the good news, of their ways that they didn't have the chance to hear of before, and there's some kind of a mystical, non-earthly conversion that goes on with those who are already dead and are waiting to be judged, and that Jesus has converted them as well. No. It's actually fairly simply read to say that this gospel has been preached. So those, even those who have already died from the time when the gospel was proclaimed in the person of Jesus to the writing of that letter, even people we've spoken to, even those who've already died, we've at least had a chance to share this gospel with even those people. And we will do so for even more. It is quite clear in the Bible that there is no second chance of preaching to those that are already dead to give them another chance in some kind of purgatory or afterlife before the judgment happens. The Bible clearly says in Hebrews 9:27 that it's appointed for all of us to die once and then face judgment. And there is a story that Jesus describes of the scene of Lazarus and the rich man. Most of us know that story. And it has meanings in many ways, one of which, of course, is the challenge to live compassionately for those who are without in this life, but also the challenge that says you've really only got one chance, that while we are alive, now is the time to tell the truth. Because the story goes like this. Lazarus is a beggar, a poor bloke, who lives outside of the house of a very rich guy. We don't even know the rich man's name. He's just the rich man. And Lazarus suffers greatly in this life, but eventually the two of them both die. And the scene shows that Lazarus is with Abraham, representing life and comfort and connection and safety. But the rich man, he's over suffering flames and pain and discomfort. And he begs Lazarus, tell my family, let me go back to tell my family to live right, to respond to God. Let me go back and tell them. And Jesus makes it clear in the story. Lazarus says to him, this chasm between us and back to this life, there's no going back. So when anyone ever says to you, this is about, there's another opportunity, no, there is not. And that's why whenever I conduct funerals, I always say, now's the time. Now's the only opportunity that we have to let those that you love know that you love them. This is the only time we get to tell them, hey, look, you know, Jesus can forgive you. To say, you have a chance to be made right with God. Only while we live do we get that opportunity. The urgency, therefore, is upon us all. But most importantly, Peter wants to contrast what it means to live according to the will of humankind, to live according to our own desires and to the way the rest of the world says. Compare that with living according to the will of God. Now, living by God's will isn't necessarily a specific and enslaving course of action that says, God says, I want you to do that, then that, then that, then that. That sense of guidance from God happens only very, very rarely. How many of you in your life have had a direct, specific event? No, actually, I won't ask it, but I do know for sure that for very few people does God say, do this now, do that now. Most of us at various stages in our life where we've had to face crossroads and big decisions, we've sought God's guidance as his wives to do so. And from time to time, God will tell you a specific course of action. Will say, follow this way, do that thing, go there. For the most part, however, when it means to follow God's will, it means essentially, living according to the way that he says. The principles of justice and mercy, faith in God, trust that he is the only one by which we may be forgiven, reconciliation, submission, humility. And living according to God's will means living these ways. So rather than seeing God's will as a paddock, as a line, a road which we must face, and don't take that side course there, no, we'll go that one instead and go that one and following a specific line and a direction, it is more, we have a paddock to play in. We have an area, God's will is for the most part, here's some guidelines, here's how you need to live, go work it out, as long as you continue to live within the guidelines and the principles that I have revealed. So living by God's will isn't necessarily about saying, because, boy, that brings about so much fear and uncertainty where we think, what if I get it wrong? What if I do the wrong thing? Well, sometimes we do. Sometimes we mishear. Sometimes our own expectations and hopes do get the better of ourselves when it comes to the time where we want to hear something specific from God. For the most part, when God says we ought to live by God's will, it is to say, we're going to live this way. I'm going to make decisions for my family, for my lifestyle, for my work, my career, that are within the bounds of a godly lifestyle. God's will is more about a set of values, and he says we're going to do it so that we please God. God loves and delights for us to be able to do that. God loves for us to explore his will, to explore his world, so long as we do so within the safe confines and the guidance of his will that says, if you do things this way, you'll be blessed and I'll be glorified. If you do things that way, you will miss out and I will be dishonoured, is the way that God says this. So living according to the will of God is to know the difference between, I'm going to let these things drive me or those things drive me. Now, so very often our lifestyle looks different from the rest of the world around us. We can see that our morality is different, that our values are different, that we are no longer driven by the very same things that drive the rest of this world. And they don't understand why it is that you just won't try this new sensation, that you won't buy this new product, that you won't indulge in this joy that we enjoy ourselves in. And it is challenging and it can be heartbreaking, and sometimes it will involve that people will cause pain and will speak ill of you because they just don't get it. That's the bad news. The good news is God will still be pleased, that God will still look at you at the end of the day and say, thank you, well done, good and faithful, and your efforts to live a distinctive way, your efforts to speak to others have still borne fruit. We never know for sure what our lifestyle, what the words we say and the things that we do can affect other people. But for us, it's time to change. For us, it's time to say, I'm not going to let that control me anymore. Look, I want to encourage you, maybe there is something that is of influence of you right now. Maybe, and I didn't do much of this morning, but it's really been on me this afternoon that I really should have called for some kind of a response or at least a challenge to do something with what I say today. If there is for any of you something that is tangling you up, something that is driving you, that is not a particularly godly value, some purpose that you're pursuing that's not of God, I want to encourage you to go and talk to somebody. I'm not going to call you to come up the front here or even talk to me specifically. But the challenge is that if God is in this particular desire, great, if there's something, some force, some old habit perhaps that might be getting a hold of you, I want to encourage you to go seek some help with that. Go and talk to somebody. Pray with them, whatever it might be, because we have a new identity in Christ, do we not? We have a reborn identity with a new purpose, a new set of values, and sometimes we get tangled up in other old stuff. And it's going to be an ongoing battle. The challenge is going to be always there. But there's help, there's opportunity, there is support, and there's people here to pray for you.